Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about indigenous agricultural practices today and also indigenous plant varieties. Our guest, Dan Cornelius, is a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. He's an outreach specialist at the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center. And he's going to talk about, among other things, the Three Sisters Research Garden located in the UW-Madison Arboretum. So, do you have questions about native seeds? What would you like to know about indigenous gardening methods? Love to have you part of the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Dan Cornelius, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Have you always grown, as growing food, let's put it this way, has growing food always been a part of your life?
I've been growing indigenous corns for almost 15 years, but when I was a kid, my mom had done some gardening, I kind of have taught myself how to grow over the years and then, you know, learned a lot from others along the way.
Kind of the way I got started and got going. So we're well alike in that regard for sure. Well, let's talk about the Indigenous Research Garden at the UW Arboretum. What is it working on? What is it and what's it working on?
Yeah. So we started... It was called the Three Sisters Garden, and now we call it the UW Indigenous Research Garden, and it's right on Monroe Street in Madison, part of the Arboretum, right at the edge of the Arboretum there, and we're having some conversations a couple of years ago, and you know, I just kind of brought up the point that. That there's not really a lot of the indigenous story and history within the Arboretum. And, you know, they talk about discovering, you know, pioneering the use of fire for prairie and savanna restoration. And, you know, when I'd hear that, I just kind of give a little bit of a pause and think that, you know, indigenous people have been using fire as a land management practice in this area for hundreds and really thousands of years, and that's part of the contributor of why we had the landscape that we had 150 years ago. It's part of still why we have the soils today. And so, you know, how do we bring more of that recognition of our indigenous practices, and how do we bring more of our food system back to the area? And I think a lot of people don't recognize that the Madison or the Desjardins area, as Ho-Chunks refer to it, what was our historic food system here? And we had rice that surrounded the edges of most of the lakes, all the low swampy ground. That was all wild rice fields. And corn would have been a staple of the diet as well. And so, you know, I think that's part of the effort is to bring back to bring back some of the foods and to have a place right, you know, right in the city, right on campus to be able to grow it. And so in addition to corn, we've got corn planted now. We're going to be planting some squash and some beans. We've got wild rice growing there as well.
Oh, so I did not realize you had wild rice growing there as well. Where is it growing in the Arboretum? I assume along the lake there.
Also, we're actually growing it in 5-gallon buckets. Right. Now. It was some seed that I had collected locally there's just a couple little spots where I still does grow in the lakes here, and I had collected some a couple of years ago, and I kept it in my refrigerator over the winter. The seed needs to what's called stratify, and stratification is giving that seed the right conditions. A lot of seeds need to be You know, they need usually need cold temperatures. Sometimes they'll need hot, then cold temperatures. In the case of rice, it needs that cold temperature over a period of time to get to a point where it's ready to germinate and to start to grow. So I kept it in my refrigerator in a bottle with some, you know, soaked in some water. And then in the spring, took those seeds out and they were starting to sprout, and went and collected some muck from that same area where I had collected the seed from. And so that's what's in the bottom of the buckets there. And then, yeah, I just planted the seeds right in those buckets. And then they actually reseeded themselves from seed last year, and they're growing again this year.
That's very cool. Is there, do you envision somehow getting it established along the lake, or are you just going to keep going? Talk about that.
Yeah. I think that would be my hope. And that's kind of one of our next steps, is to really work on how and where to do that. I think it would be a pretty clear that we'd want to do it close by one of the springs or some of the springs. And because, that spring water is just cleaner. And so that rice is probably going to do better around one of those springs. But yeah, that's part of what my hope would be for the longer term, is to try to work to establish it. And, probably out of all of the lakes here, probably Wingra is, I would think, probably the best suited for bringing rice back. Rice is kind of, it needs the right conditions to be able to grow and to thrive. And those conditions aren't quite the same today as what they would have been, 150 or 200 years ago.
Yeah. Dan Cornelius, our guest outreach specialist at the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center, and part of the, and working at the research garden, the Indigenous Research Garden at UW Arboretum as well, doing some interesting things there. You can join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Let me talk about the history. How important was agriculture to the Native peoples of Wisconsin?
Well, I think that the term agriculture is it's an interesting term. It's
the wrong term, maybe.
Really, well, no, I think it's actually I think it's the right term. It's the term that I use. I've worked for the Intertribal Agriculture Council for about 10 years, and but agriculture, a lot of the work I've done is working with USDA, with the United States Department of Agriculture, to get them to recognize something like wild rice that I just was talking about as agriculture and as an agricultural practice. And we've had some pretty good success in making that happen, but there still is at times challenges of where some of the indigenous agriculture doesn't neatly fit within the ideas of cows and plows. But the efforts to, in the instance of wild rice, in some ways wild rice is kind of a misnomer, that there's a lot of effort that goes into reseeding rice. There's efforts that go into managing and maintaining that population on the water. And the tribes actively manage the rice beds today, and they have, they did historically as well. So agriculture is, I look at it as more holistically, of including, of course, tapping trees and making sugar. But, a lot of the gathering and really all of our practices to create food and to feed our communities, that's all agriculture. So it just has a bit of a, I look at it a little bit more expansively than just the cows, plows, and growing gardens and fields.
Yeah, I gotcha. We've talked, or you mentioned indigenous corn a few times. How is it different from the corn you might see out in the field as you drive around southern Wisconsin?
Well, all the corn that you see out in the fields in southern Wisconsin, it's all comes from indigenous corn. At some point, it's gone through quite a bit of plant breeding, and most of the corn that you see is going to have different treatments that allow it to be planted earlier in the year. And I live out in the country and I'm surrounded by cornfields. It's pretty crazy that right now you can almost really watch that corn growing. It's growing inches a day, and so it's pretty remarkable of the modern corn. But I look at and part of what I love of working with the indigenous corns is there's just so much diversity that is within each of those seeds, and then really the stories for each of our individual varieties or seeds. I grow varieties that go back within within my tribe for hundreds of years, and just to think about how many of my ancestors that have grown the same or pretty similar corns. I just think it's got that deeper connection, that deeper history, and then the flavor and the tastes on each of the corns. That they're all unique, and how they grow is different as well. I grow Oneida. People around here call it an Oneida white corn. We call it a Tuscarora white corn because the Tuscarora brought it when they joined the Iroquois or the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, but that corn, if it's a really warm year, it's going to be really big and tall. I've grown it by Duluth, Minnesota, and we've had cold years, and it's only been about 3 feet high. So each of these corns is just so different and unique, and I think that's part of what's so exciting and part of why I like growing it.
Yeah. How's it taste? What's the dip? Kind of, can I don't know, maybe you can't describe how it tastes maybe differently from the traditional, or not traditional, the typical, let me put it that way, sweet corn that we might buy at Woodman's grocery store.
Yeah, so I guess one thing to start off with is that, there's a flower corn and a flint corn, of course, popcorns, but really that main difference between the flower corn and the flint corn, and most of our indigenous corns are one of the two of them. And the flower corn, it's going to be a bit, when it finishes, it's going to be a bit softer, and the flint corn is going to be quite a bit harder. So that flint corn is really good for making hominy. The flower corn, it's also good for hominy, but it's easier to grind it to a flour. So when you eat it, that's going to be one of those big differences. But pretty much all of the corns, we will eat them at that sweet corn stage. We call it green corn when it's at that stage. So that's going to taste a lot different when you're eating it fresh like that versus when you let it dry for a few more weeks in the field. And that's what we'll do for most of our corns to be able to then harvest and put them into big braids for storing and for drying them down. There's going to be a big difference in the flavor and the taste based on when you harvest it as well.
Dan Cornelius, our guest today, outreach specialist at the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center, having an interesting time and a fun time talking with him about native agriculture and the Indigenous Research Garden at UW Arboretum. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dan Cornelius, outreach specialist at the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center. And we're talking about indigenous agriculture and the indigenous research garden at UW Arboretum. You can join in. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Or email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Are the gardening methods different, or how are the gardening methods different from the European style, excuse me, we're so familiar with?
I think that part of my answer to that question is, in a lot of instances, our methods have changed, although a lot of people I know, they do grow corn in, or they grow Three Sisters in mounds. But today, I think for most growers, we have to contend with, you know, there's different weeds and there's different plants that are out there. So the production practices are quite a bit different today. But I think one of the most interesting articles that I read is a scholar, Jane Mount Pleasant. She taught at Cornell University for a long time, and she argues in a paper that the indigenous growers at the time of contact in the 1600s, that they were five times more productive per acre than European farmers of that same time. And it wasn't really until the plows were introduced and that the fields started getting plowed up that the yields dropped and didn't really get back to the levels of that they were historically till the 1940s and 50s. I think it's interesting to think about what were those production practices? How was food grown that effectively and efficiently? And that's a lot of what my work focuses on today. So I grow in at different scales. What I'm trying to dial in is to be able to do no-till organic corn and to do it at a scale that is efficient. It has some challenges that go along with it, but that's what I'm trying to do is to bring that back. But I do some smaller scale as well, and including doing hand planting. And we just were up at Ho-Chunk a couple of weeks ago and did a big hand planting there, and partnering with a native PhD student at UW-Madison, Daniel Hayden. He's a Comanche, and he's interseeding different cover crops in. So I think there's a lot of different ways that people grow today. And I think that's one of the exciting things is just to see these practices coming back and to be innovating and experimenting to do it more efficiently and to be inspired by the traditional and historic ways of growing. But for me, also incorporating some modern techniques and technology as well.
Yeah. Well, we should take some calls and let our listeners join in here. Again, you can call at 1-800-642-1234 or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. John in Appleton, we'll give you a chance. John, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Good morning. Fascinating topic. Just curious, what is the proper term, or how do I call the multicolored corn that people decorate their homes with? I know when I was a kid, we called it Indian corn, but that's obviously not what it should be called. What is it? And is it a native variety?
It's a good question. I think it's probably, yes, I would say it's definitely connected to native varieties or indigenous varieties. And the exact, what you see in the store, though, I think it's going to depend on where those growers got those seeds from. I think you could call it an indigenous corn if you wanted to. That's a good question of exactly where those different seeds come from, and it's really going to depend on where those growers got them.
Yeah, where do you get your seeds from? And how do you find out where they originated?
Oh, that really depends on the seeds. And one of the exciting efforts over the past few years is the creation of the Indigenous Seed Keepers Network. And you know, really going back 6-7 years, we had done some different seed trainings, and kind of coming out of that, a White Earth Land Recovery Project had put a grant in, and Zach Page was their coordinator, and we got this grant to help support doing doing these trainings. And we'd have these phone calls. Once a month, we'd have a phone call, a check-in, and everyone would talk about how their corn was doing. And almost everybody was growing that Oneida white corn that I had referenced before, because that's what was the most available. And after all those calls, Jeff Metoxin, I was the farm manager at Oneida, and Jeff would call me up, and we would just talk. And Jeff would, you know, he was very passionate of that it's great that everybody's growing our white corn, but they need to be growing their own corn again. And just to see in the past 6-7 years, the expanded access to, you know, to the different corns, and we call it rematuriation of returning the seeds back to the communities from which they originated, to see that effort accelerate and expand. And just that, the access that our Indigenous growers have to different seeds, and you know, in some cases it may not be the exact seed that was grown in their community, but if we can find something similar, and you know, it's pretty tough that Oneida white corn is 110-115 day corn, you know, so that refers to from the time you plant it to when you harvest it. That's tough to grow a 115 day corn in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan or northern Minnesota. So, you know, so to see more of these corns coming back is really exciting. And that's part of the efforts that we've been doing at the Indigenous Research Garden and looking at, mm-hmm. you know, at even how those different corns, how they grow in comparison to one another.
Let's take another call. Sherry in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to know if the Indigenous corn is more tolerant of weeds and takes less fertilizer, if it would be actually easier to grow. And then I'm also wondering how the nutrition compares. Maybe it's more healthy for us?
Yeah, good questions there. A lot of them are going to be a little bit more tolerant for weeds. Some of them kind of vary though. Of some of our corns are fairly slender and smaller stalks, and some of them are 10, 12 feet tall. Again, that's going to somewhat depend on the conditions that they're growing in. But on the nutritional side, most of the Indigenous corns are going to have higher protein content and more amino acids in them, but also comes back to, you know, to the question of the flavor, the taste, and how we cook them. It's not just the seeds themselves; it's the preparation methods that help to maximize the nutrition. And when we go through a process of what's called mixed demolization, I do it. Most of our growers do it with a hardwood ash. It's adding niacin into that corn and calcium, and it makes it easier for your body to digest. So it's not just the seed and the food itself, but it's how we cook it is also part of that question on nutrition.
And so when you're talking about the ash, describe a little more about the preparation then.
Yeah, so I teach at the university, and we do, we would do cooking labs, and now this year we had to just do a virtual. I was teaching from my kitchen, and so what we do is we start off, we'll soak that corn, and then bring it up to a boil, and and then sift in. I just use ash out of my wood burning stove. Sift it to make sure there's no little chunks in there, and then you sift it in, and for that white corn, it'll go from white to just this bright, like sunset gold, orange color, and that's that chemical reaction that's happening, and it's breaking down that outer hull on the corn. So then a couple of different ways you can do it is you can just either boil it, or some folks, especially from Latin America, will more let it sit and steep overnight, and then rinse it and put clean water in, and then boil it again. And that's how you make hominy or masa. That corn then can be ground down to a flour, and that's what tortilla chips and tamales, and that's what they're made out of.
Interesting. Again, appreciate that question. Kate in Madison emailed. She's wondering if there are any native squash varieties. She hopes someday she can pick up a seed catalog and see all these varieties of corn, rice, squash, etc. It would be so exciting.
There are definitely surviving heritage indigenous squashes. I think the topic of to be able to pick up a seed catalog and just to see all of these seeds in there, that raises some other questions of not all of our communities really necessarily want their seeds out there for anyone to be able to access. And some of it comes back to these seeds being taken over the years and had different experiments done with them, and companies making big profits off of them, and then and really using them in ways that a lot of our indigenous growers aren't really comfortable with. That's part of where there's sometimes a hesitancy and a resistance to having these seeds just out there for anyone to be able to access. But there's also really a responsibility that goes along with maintaining these seeds. And I think that is one of the other big considerations and with most of our growers. I mean, we really try to put the protocols in place to really be respecting and caring for that seed so that we can continue to pass it on to future generations.
Hmm. Someone else wondered how you get all the different varieties, indigenous types of corns. How were they discovered if now there's... are rediscovered or found now that this area is growing among indigenous populations?
There's different, the seeds have come back in different ways. A lot of them have just been, have been cared for and grown by different growers for years and years and then passed down in families. Some of them have gone to to other growers. A Seed Savers Exchange has really brought together a lot of the seeds, and a lot of these rematriation efforts are being led by Seed Savers Exchange. And sometimes it's just some seed gets shared, and someone grows it out for several years, and or their whole lives. And so that's one of those ways. I think for me, one of the really one of the impactful moments is we were organizing the hosting this food summit up at Red Lake in Minnesota, and there was a Red Lake elder who was doing a demonstration on making that hominy corn. And at one point, he had come up to me and asked if he could have some corn that I brought up. I brought just a whole big van load of corn, and we had a big husking bee and were braiding the corn. And he asked if he could have some, and I just had a little bit of this one particular kind, but I gave it to him, and he came back a little bit later with a handful of what turned out to be this Red Lake Flint corn. And he gave me some specific directions of how to take care of it. And that seed, until that event, no one else had that seed. It had been just passed down in his family. And you know, he looked at it really as one of his kids and wanted to see it, you know, continue to be grown and realized that he needed to share it to be able to have it continue. So now that's one of many stories, but we have seed keepers that have been doing this work for their whole lives, and a lot of them are the leaders that have been continuing to maintain and to grow them over the years.
Yeah. Rita in Wisconsin Rapid emailed to ask you to talk about growing squash, beans, and corn together, and, you know, when should they be planted and so forth and so on. But that's the Three Sisters method, I believe, is it not?
Yeah, the Three Sisters. And so generally how it works is you plant your corn first, and you give that corn enough time to start to, you know, to grow and to establish itself. And then you plant the beans and the squash a little bit later. Or you can plant the squash at the same time, but just give it a little bit more space from the corn. Because once that squash takes off, it'll want to drag down the corn. And then for the beans, we use a corn stalk bean. So a corn stalk bean is basically just a small pole bean. And there are certain varieties that are, you know, that's what they are, is the corn stalk beans. And they've just been selected over the years that, you know, they'll be just about 3, maybe 4 feet tall. Because if you have a pole bean that's too big, it'll, you know, same thing as a lot of them will want to pull that corn down. So, you know, to really get the Three Sisters working right, it's just really about that timing and then how you space everything as well. I do a little bit of it, but I don't grow too much of in the Three Sisters method, except I do more of the Two Sisters of I'll do corn and then I'll do my squash and pumpkins and have the squash and pumpkins grow right into the corn. But sometimes if I have a gaps of the birds, maybe we'll get a little bit and there'll be a gap in the corn, then I'll plant some beans in those gaps.
Barry wonders asks if you could talk about the no-till method of growing corn.
So this is where, you know, combining some modern technology, modern equipment. I'm using a four-row no-till planter. It's an old John Deere, and it's a pretty heavy-duty planter. It's, you know, it's designed as a no-till conservation planter. And so what I'm doing is I just maximize the pressure on that, and I've got these row cleaners on there that kind of clear out the grasses, and I'm just doing this straight into perennial grasses. And then I've got some liquid fertilizer. I use organic nitrogen on there and plant that. And then what I do, and this is where figuring out how to scale this up. I just was at the UW-Madison, the Arlington Research Station yesterday, and we were kind of talking on some of this, but how do you keep then those grasses down enough for the corn to establish itself? And what I do is I use a walk behind mower and I just mow in between those rows. So it does take quite a bit of time. It's not something, you know, how I'm doing it now would not really work at a scale of 100 acres, but I can do it at a few acres and just trying to get that, all of those, you know, different the timing and the biggest thing is the fertilizer. And when I've done this in really good soil, it's done pretty well. Last year was kind of tough with the drought. It was real dry in August, but that's the basics of how that works.
It interesting process indeed. And you kind of build up a little muscle too if you're doing all that mowing.
Yeah, it you know, muscle, and then you know, I'm trying to just get right onto those rows, and then I'm there at Arlington, at the Arlington Research Station yesterday, and they've got all, I've never seen as many big fancy tractors anywhere, and all of them are satellite, you know, guided, and they were showing me this this new experimental device that they have, and you know, to go in between the rows, and I said, how do you not hit your rows? And they say, oh, we can go down to less than an inch of accuracy with the GPS. So I'm not quite at that point with my growing, but you know, but it's interesting to see what we have. And you know, a lot of my work focuses on food sovereignty, and you know, really, what does food sovereignty mean? A big part of what it means is for being able to feed our communities. And, you know, just to quickly connect in to one of the big exciting efforts that that I've been a part of work coordinating with Feeding Wisconsin and Feeding America in partnership with Oneida and Menominee and Red Cliff, and are working with some other tribal growers as well for doing a tribal elder food box distribution. And so the relevance to seeds and to the production is, we're trying to use this effort to help to expand our production, to be able to provide the support that we can buy directly from, you know, from our tribal growers and have it go right to our elders. But, you know, but we need more production. So it is exciting that we're also working with Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative and non-native growers as well. But, you know, but that's one of the exciting things in the seeds. You know, how do we produce more to be able to, you know, have enough quantity to feed our elders and our communities?
Well, it's you're doing some really interesting and some great work, Dan. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talking about the whole process and about the Indigenous Research Garden at the Arboretum. Do you have hopes for what that garden might expand to?
Yeah, I think what my hope is to have more places like that on campus and, you know, and within the Dajo-Madison area, to be able to grow food again. And, you know, it's not just the Indigenous Research Garden, but we've also been collaborating with the Arboretum on doing a sugar bush. So we've been tapping trees and making maple, and we also did a box elder and black walnut trees as well. But, you know, to really have the hands-on learning opportunities, because those spaces then help to give an outdoor classroom. I know for my class in both the fall and the spring, we've gone out to those locations and we've used them as part of our classroom, and to be expanding really the idea of education, that it's not just sitting in a lecture hall and listening to someone talk at you for an hour. It's being able to get hands-on and to be able to experience it. And I know coming out of the pandemic, well, not coming out of the pandemic, but right in the middle of the pandemic, last September, classes got shut down. Campus got shut down. Our first in-person class, we were able to get together and braid corn. And that's for first year students. And you know, that's what my hope is for the longer term, is to see more of those opportunities and really use this to help to expand and transform our overall educational model.
Dan, a pleasure talking with you again. Thank you so much. And we'll look forward to another visit from you. I hope you'll agree to do that.
Sounds good.
Dan Cornelius, Outreach Specialist at the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center. Interesting guy, and he's doing a lot of really cool work with Indigenous gardens and Indigenous plants. Well, we're going to turn our attention a little bit to flowers next and talk about wildflowers. There are more than 500 wildflower species in Wisconsin, one of the best states to find wildflowers. And our next guest is going to be talking about where you can go, best places to go to see those wildflowers. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to the Ideas Network.